This is Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Eric Thiel. Welcome to another live session coming to you today from the JPR Reading Studios. And joining me today, the Canadian duo Tegan and Sarah.
Hi.
Welcome, you guys.
Hi.
It's nice to meet you. Thanks for stopping by. Out in support of the newest album, it's called Heartthrob. Information on the disc at teganandsarah.com. We've been familiar with your music for 14 years, something like that, going all the way back to when you were much more of an acoustic indie folk rock duo. Mm-hmm. Heartthrob is a pretty straightforward pop record, probably the glossiest thing that you guys have ever put out. Was that the intent going into crafting a collection of 10 or so songs?
Absolutely, yeah. We really wanted to make something that would be a surprise to people. I mean, when we're making records, we always are making things that we like, that we enjoy, and also that is sonically representative of music that we're listening to. So as you pointed out, over a 14-year career in the public, much longer just, playing music since we were kids, we've obviously gone through a few different sounds and iterations of the band, and I think that's just about, just the actual time that we've been around. You sort of go through little phases. We were really into indie rock in the early 2000s, and then we sort of started to transition really sort of slowly into pop music, and now we're really like, okay, we're here, we've got a pop record, like, take a listen to this. So,
and that's not just the music you make, but it's also the music you listen to, correct?
Absolutely.
That you have transitioned over the years?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but, we always, the easiest way when people ask, like, why do you think your music's changed so much, is just to remind people it has been over a decade. So, music's changed, the world's changed, technology, recording technology, what's popular has changed, and what we listen to has changed. When we put out our first record, we just graduated high school.
Right.
So 1998, so the music was different back then.
Yeah, and we've spent a lot of time cultivating this really amazing fan base, but most of that fan base came to us from a lot of different avenues and channels, and some of the biggest successes we've had have actually been outside of our project. So we had a massive song with Tiësto called Feel It In My Bones, and experimenting with electronic music, we realized how open-minded the audience was and how diverse it was, and we realized that that was something we should probably spend a little more time and energy on, and the list goes on. I mean, we pull from a million places, whether it's opening for people like Neil Young or The Killers to doing the Lego movie theme song, Everything Is Awesome. I mean, we're constantly looking at ways to diversify and to increase our audience, but also to challenge ourselves as artists. At this point, the saddest thing I can imagine for Sarah and I is phoning it in. Just playing because we have to, or just trying to make money. Instead, we just try to come up with new creative ways to inspire our audience and inspire ourselves. And that means taking very calculated risks. They're not frantic, ridiculous risks. Heartthrob was a calculated risk. We knew our audience appreciated pop music, and we knew that they were supportive of us doing collaborations. And we thought, well, let's try to bridge the gap between those things and make a pop record.
This thing debuted at number 3. On the Billboard charts. Mm-hmm. Looking back at the Tegan and Sarah of 10 years ago and the kind of music you guys made 10 years ago, could you have ever imagined that you guys would have an album at number 3 on Billboard?
I don't think that we were certainly aiming for that when we first started out. I think that we had a smaller scale, in mind. For us, like, simple things like selling out a club, I mean, we would be like, we sold out. It didn't even matter to us how many tickets. Like, just the idea that you could sell out a venue was still really exciting to us. But to be in the music industry for so long and to understand the boundaries of it much better, it becomes easier to set different kinds of goals. And some of those goals would have seemed, crazy,
yeah,
in the beginning of our career. But now to say, like, okay, we have created a fan base that is excited and interested and anticipating our next release. So to be able to say, like, we'd like to have a top 5 on the Billboard charts when our record comes out, doesn't feel like something, it's not a crazy dream. It's actually like, it's a real career goal.
Yeah.
Like, we're like, well, we've been working for 15 years. We should be able to get on the Billboard charts,
right?
So
this record, and you guys have talked about this a lot in interviews that you've done, has a lot of what you referred to as radio-friendly tunes.
Mm-hmm.
How do you guys, the songwriters, approach writing a radio-friendly song? What does that really mean?
Well, the truth is that we don't use the word radio. No offense.
Lots taken.
No, I mean, it's sort of actually, there's a good parallel here, which is how we create a set list to play live. You pick the songs people like.
Mm.
you know, there are songs from our catalog that we've redone, or we've, Sarah calls it, you know, Botoxing it. You know, we've gone through and actually, like, you know, livened it up, and then the audience loves it. But the truth is that there's very obvious songs from each record that people love. Where Does the Good Go? Always been a fan favorite. So we play it. Mm. You know, Walking with a Ghost did well on radio. People really loved it. So we play it. And I think that just over that decade of making music, we established there's a certain formula to how we feel when we write a certain song, and like, and there's a formula to write music that people appeal or appeals to people and that they like and want to listen to and sing along to. And so when we sit down to write a record like Heartthrob, as I said, we don't necessarily use the word radio. We use the word, how do we make a record that appeals to people? How do we make a record that will appeal to radio or to the mainstream? How do we find new fans? How do we create new channels and avenues to share our music? And that means, you know, we use the blueprint from the past. Okay, songs like Back in Your Head and, you know, like, these are very pop songs. They weren't produced out like pop songs. They were more indie pop and indie rock. But there's a formula to how those songs are written. They make sense. They tell a story. They connect with you as a human being. And so we just wrote 10 songs like that. We were just focused on that.
There's a phenomenon that you guys have obviously are aware of between music fans and music journalists and DJs and all of this sort of thing. When an artist crosses over into the mainstream, that somehow they're no longer as credible or they're no longer as authentic or something like that. Yeah. Is that a conversation that you guys have gone through as a band, that our music is crossing over into more of the mainstream, but we want to maintain the same integrity or credibility that we had when we were selling out small clubs and we were an indie band?
You know, it's funny. I don't know if it's because we're women or because we, at least on paper, or it seemingly appeared to others right at the very beginning of our career that we had already made it. Like getting signed at 20 years old to Neil Young's record label, it didn't matter that we made, I think I made like $13,000 that year or something. Like, I was living well below the poverty line, you know, and it was like, but you made it. Oh my God, Neil Young signed you to this record deal. So almost at the very beginning of our career, we started to hear, you know, this idea of like, are you selling out? Is your music credible? You know, are you manufactured? Is someone behind what you do? And it infuriated us. And it's been a pulse through a lot of our career, is making sure that people understand how truly deeply embedded in this world we are. Like, we understand the music industry better than a lot of the artists that we're friends with, even. Like, you know, we've had to sort of like prove ourselves, not just songwriters, not just like people who play on stage or perform, you know, using instruments or whatever it is. Like, Tegan and I, we you know, managed our own career for years. We only this year at 34 years old just did a publishing deal for the very first time. I mean, we were deeply, deeply invested in ensuring that we were in control of our career. And so we took it very personal when people would suggest that there was some kind of puppeteer behind us, whether it was
me all along.
Tegan is the puppeteer, but she does that. But yeah, like, I think each time we sort of establish ourselves on a new level, there are always people who will suggest, oh, well, I liked them better when they were insert whatever, like folk, short hair, you know, less feminine, you know, less popular. Like, you know, we hear these things all the time, and we just feel like, you know, there is no way that we are going to address feeling like selling out, like we're sellouts, from a place of actually worrying that we're sellouts. I do think it's fair to want to establish sometimes how not sell out we really are, but it's usually coming from a place of wanting to say, like, oh no, you've got it all wrong. Like, if anything, we're more DIY than we ever were. We're more invested than we ever were. We love being a more popular band, and we are very aware of trying to make sure that people understand there's a positivity in becoming more popular. It's not about, now I'm just like doing blow in my like hot tub of sadness. Like, it's not like that. You know, it's actually really cool to be more popular.
That is the quote of the year.
Yeah. You're welcome. Yeah.
Tegan and Sarah are my guests live in the JPR Reading Studios. Their new album is called Heartthrob. Lots of additional information on the band and the duo, teganandsarah.com. Before we have you play a tune, who have you brought in to round out the ensemble here in the studio?
We have our very lovely and handsome, talented early morning risers, Ted Gowans on guitar and John Spence on keyboard. And John's new to the operation with this record, but Ted's actually been with us now for 10 years. So he loves playing acoustically with us.
And what do you guys want to do first?
We're going to play a song called Back in Your Head off of a record that came out in 2007 called The Con.
1, 2, 3, 4. A
between us in my bed. Repeat, repeat the words that I know we both said. Relax into the knee, we get so comfortable. Remember when I was so strange and likable. It's her important parts of you. Remember when I was sweet and unexplainable. I'm nothing like this person unlovable.
That is Back in Your Head. It's Tegan and Sarah live in the JPR Reading studios. They are out on tour supporting their newest release. It's called Heartthrob. Information on the band at teganandsarah.com. You guys are originally from Calgary, correct?
Yeah.
How'd you meet?
It was a sunny Saturday morning, early morning. Sarah and I joined this world at 5:56 and 6:04 a.m.
As I mentioned earlier, you know, we've been familiar with your music since about 2000. It was This Business of Art, I think, was the first one that we got at the station. Mm-hmm. And obviously, as we've talked, your music has changed a lot. But outside of the music, what has been the biggest overall change for you guys as a performing duo and now full band?
I mean, one of my favorite things to recount is that when we put out Sainthood, which came out right before our 30th birthday, a lot of the press was asking questions about, like, well, are you guys gonna slow down now and have, you know, get off the road and find partners and get married and have children? And, like, I found it incredibly insulting. And, you know, Sarah would return those questions with more questions about, like, do you ask male acts this, you know, like, if Radiohead came in, are you asking them questions like that, you know? But I have noticed that one of the biggest changes that has occurred, at least in me, in the last, you know, 10 years, but specifically the last couple, with an intensity that I've noticed, is that I think there is a balance between personal and private and the business and the touring and the professional career, all that stuff. The desire to not always be on the road, the desire to have a foundation and have structure in my life and safety and savings and all that, like planning for the future, these have been huge changes, and they've affected our life on the road and our career a lot, because we're trying to be more responsible, we're trying to be more calculated, we're planning ahead, we're investing more. I mean, with this record, we expanded our crew, our touring operation, our level of comfort has increased, and it means sacrificing profit, but we feel that it's important to surround ourselves with people who are really healthy and really talented, and it means paying them more. And I just think that when you're 20 years old and you're out on the road, you just don't think about those things. Yeah. So I mean, a lot has shifted because of our age and how long we've been in the industry. But I just think the biggest thing is just we're taking better care of ourselves.
There's an often talked about twin connection that permeates life in all of its different configurations. But I found it really interesting that you guys didn't write songs together for a really long time. Mm-hmm. Is it because you're very different from one another, or what was the reason behind always writing separately?
I don't know that we ever really even addressed it or talked about it. It was just sort of very natural when we started writing music in high school. We had two guitars. Tegan wrote songs in her room and I wrote songs in my room. And I think that because there was no... we weren't thinking about like how other people were going to see it. It was an exciting new thing that we could do.
But did you write them individually with the idea that you would perform them together?
Not always. In fact,
I don't think that we wrote with the intention of performing initially.
No, it was just sort of like figuring out that you could do, like I'm just like stretching my mind to try to like think of an analogy, but the truth is that I really enjoyed writing music alone and it didn't have anything really to do with Tegan. And then I could see that Tegan really enjoyed it. And so when we sort of started to be persuaded to play the songs for other people, there was a sort of like instinct to like, well, I guess if I'm just sitting here waiting for you to finish your song, I could also help you and do some stuff on it, you know? And so it sort of was sort of clumsy beginning in terms of like, you know, we weren't strategically saying like, we are a band, we will perform together. We just were two people who were performing and sort of like naturally fell into accompanying each other. But it has remained, I think, one of the best parts of what we do is that there's this sort of solitary element where you get to go away from being on camera or on radio or on stage with all these people and you get to go do it by yourself. And it's not because I don't trust Tegan or don't like her or don't think that she has a great instinct or, you know, adds really wonderful things to my songs. It's really about not wanting to be around anyone. There's a bit of a meditative thing that happens when you're alone for days and days and days working on a song. And Tegan is a mirror. She reflects for me how I look, how I feel, what she's hearing. And so it's almost like for me to really go deep into a song, it's important that I don't have that mirror there. Mm. And when I bring Tegan into that process, it's clarifying and she sort of plays an editor or producer role later in the process. But that's just what's always worked for us.
Tegan and Sarah are my guests live in the JPR Reading Studios. Their newest release is called Heartthrob. Information on the band at teganandsarah.com. What do you guys want to play next?
We're going to play you a song off our new record called I Was a Fool.
Do you remember I searched you out? How I climbed your city's walls? Do you remember me as the vow? How I prayed for your cause? I stood still. What I did, love, lie, houses I never fixed. I stuck around, I did behave. I saved you every time. I was a fool for love. I was a fool for love. God last. Then you disappear for weeks to power. How many times could I pack by? Stand still is all I get. Love, lie, houses that never fixed. I stuck around, I did behave. I saved you every time. Space. You best be
That is Deegan and Sarah live on Jefferson Public Radio. Their newest album is called Heartthrob. Just before the tune, you talked about how it wasn't an issue of liking or not liking your sister. But there was a period of time, as I understand, that you guys were not particularly getting along well. Did it come close to separating you as a performing group?
You know, I mean, looking back, it's hard to probably establish like a true like percentage of like where like was it really like we were truly going to break up, or was it just shenanigans and histrionics when we were fighting? Yeah. I don't know. It's tough to look back and really truly have a sense of what was happening. But I think we were, especially at the beginning of our career, walking this very fine line of this is fun and an adventure and a hobby, but kind of a passion, and woo, we're taking this risk and just taking a year off. And the other side of the line, which was we've made a terrible mistake. What are we doing? Where does our life really go from here? What are we good at? And I think most people at that age, you know, 19, 20, 21, they're at college or they're working or they're away from their family and friends for the first time, and they're really establishing who they are. And we were stuck with each other. So I'm not even sure that most of our conflict had anything to do. I'm not sure that had anything to do with us being twins. I think it just had to do with us being independent, you know, new human beings to the adult world. So, but there was definitely heated times. There was lots of struggle. There was strife. There was a lot of like, exhausting like kind of moments of like trying to figure out who we were and how to do this, how to do it without suffocating each other, like how to let you be your own person and also let your, you know, twin sister be your own person, but then also share a t-shirt and a band and a hotel room and a career and a life and everything else. So there was some tough times.
You guys live in different cities now, correct?
Yeah.
How does that change the sisterly dynamic when you come together for touring or recording?
So I moved away to Montreal in 2002. So it's been a long time. Like, we're coming up on almost 13 years of being in different cities. And I mean, it's almost coming up on the same amount of time we ever lived in the same city. So it's so intrinsic to like how we work and what our lifestyle is like. We spend probably more time with each other than any normal sibling would ever spend with their other family members. I mean, we're on the road sometimes over 200 days a year. I mean, how many days do you spend with your siblings? Probably not 200 plus days as an adult. So in a weird way, living in separate cities is a bit of a reprieve. Yeah, a reprieve. It's the only normal way to deal with having to spend so much time together. It allows us to really form really specific and unique identities and not have to feel the pressure to always be part of the unit. So I really liked that. We actually are both talking about being in the same city for the first time in about 13 years. Yeah. And I'm sure that that'll cause really interesting, creative ideas to come up and maybe a little bit of conflict. But I think, you know, we're old enough now, I think, probably to deal with it in a more mature way than when I was 22 and I was like, I got to get out of here. I'll live anywhere, you know, I just got to be away from her.
You know, earlier we talked about musical evolution and that crossover into pop and maintaining musical integrity. And in passing, you referenced earlier the Lego Movie, right? Now, talking about crossing over into pop, that probably does it more so than anything. You have essentially created a song that is going to live in the heads of parents for the next generation, a song they'll never get out of their head.
It's not going to be out of our heads either. So.
And it's a song that almost parodies popular culture. How were you approached to do that song, and what made you say, yeah, let's do it?
Well, throughout our career, we've complained a lot actually about not being in movies. Like, we get a lot of TV action. Like, we get, like, a lot of our music has been placed in really amazing TV shows, but we're always like, why aren't we that band that gets the trailer for the, you know, new whatever I don't know why I'm thinking James Cameron, but you know what I mean? Like, just like we never get any movie action. So we got this email about the Lego movie, and they were apparently having a few bands create demo versions of a song called Everything Is Awesome. I listened to the song, and I mean, I, like most people, probably my instinct was, this is really cool, but also kind of intense. And we were in Europe, and Sarah and I talked about it, and we thought, well, it doesn't hurt to throw down some vocals on this song and see what happens. We had really no idea what it was going to end up being. We still didn't know who was producing it or anything like that. So sent the vocals in, and a couple days later, we heard back from our managers. They said, oh, the movie people loved it, and they've chosen you. You're the chosen ones to be the voice of this song. So we were like really excited. And as the news trickled in, it was actually really exciting because Mark Mothersbaugh was doing the music for the film. So we found out we were going to do the song with him. They hadn't figured out who was going to do the rap section in the middle. There were some pretty hilarious names thrown about, but we were excited when Lonely Island signed up because we know Andy and we think Lonely Island are hilarious. And so a couple weeks later, I flew to LA and was in the studio with Mark Mothersbaugh and recorded all my parts. And then they sort of mixed it, sent it to Sarah. She did her own vocals for the backgrounds. And then we waited, just sat around waiting to see if everybody liked it, if it was going to happen. We just really didn't know. And then they sent us a version with Lonely Island, and the movie came out, and Sarah and I saw it together in New York City. And what's really neat is that most people that see the movie probably have no idea it's us. And it's kind of the perfect scenario, because if people don't like the song, no harm done. If people love the song and they research who did it, we have a new fan.
And now you're trending among 8-year-olds.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, we're way cooler with young kids now, which is pretty cool.
Well, I want to hear one last tune before I let you go. But before, yesterday, you re-released So Jealous, 10th anniversary. Mm-hmm. What made you go back and choose that as something that you wanted to repackage and re-release?
So Jealous was probably the record that really was our breakout album. It was certainly from a sales perspective and visibility perspective, it changed our lives, it changed our career. And we have been talking about this for ages, like what will we do to sort of mark the occasion? And we started putting together the idea of re-releasing demos that we hadn't played those for people. Also, So Jealous was a record where a lot of very successful bands covered songs on the album. So for example, the White Stripes did a very popular version of Walking with a Ghost back in the day. And we thought, geez, you know, a lot of our fans now and a lot of people that are listening to our band now probably aren't even really aware of how big that record was for us, all the things that were happening. And so we started sort of putting together like archival footage, pictures, essays. All of a sudden we have we have all these great B-sides nobody's ever heard. So we've put together like a pretty extensive package, and we've got remixes. I mean, that wasn't very popular back then either, like to have DJs remix your songs. Like that's like totally just like what everyone does now. But back then that really didn't happen. So we went and approached some people to do some remixes. So the package is so exciting for us. We announced it yesterday. There's a lot of excitement within the fan base online. So we're really looking
usually
forward to
it. When we do these things, it's really aimed at the diehards. But this package, it definitely, there's like very big, crazy, extensive bundles aimed at the diehards. But it's also like we have a whole new fan base over the last 10 years, and some of them they've never even heard the record. So this is like an amazing opportunity for them to like get the whole story. It's a beautiful 110-page hardcover book with all these CDs in the back with the music, the DVDs, the live footage, the remixes. I mean, it is like the everything you could possibly want to know about that era of our lives. So it's good for just about anybody.
And there's a link to it at teganandsarah.com.
There is, yeah.
What do you guys want to wrap up with today?
So we're going to finish with a song off of Heartthrob called I'm Not Your Hero.
Standing where I am now, standing up at all, I was used to feeling like I was never gonna see myself at the finish line. Hanging on to parts of me, hanging on at all. I was used to seeing no future in my sight line. Sometimes it feels like they wanna remind me, send all those feelings after me. Thank you. like I am now, lighting up the hall. I was used to standing in the shadow of a damaged heart, learning all I know now, losing all I did. I never used to feel like I'd be standing so far ahead. Sometimes it feels what I recovered you lost, sending your peaceful arms to me. I'm not their hero, but that doesn't mean that I wasn't ready. I never walked the party line, doesn't mean that I was never afraid. I'm not your hero, but that doesn't mean we're not. Sometimes it feels like the side that I'm on plays the toughest hand, holds the longest stand. Sometimes it feels like I'm all that they've got, yet so hard to know I'm not what they want. Sometimes it feels like the side that I'm on plays the toughest hand, holds the longest stand. Sometimes it feels like I'm all that they've got. It's so hard to know I'm not what they want. I'm not their hero, but that doesn't mean that I wasn't brave. I never walked the party line, doesn't mean that I was never afraid. I'm not your hero, but that doesn't mean we're not one in the same. I do my best to walk the finest line till I've had.
That is Tegan and Sarah live in the JPR Reading studios. Their newest album is called Heartthrob. Information on the band at teganandsarah.com. Tegan, Sarah, thanks so much for stopping by and visiting with us.
Thanks for having us.